What don't people understand about Olympians? What do people...
There's a lot you don't see.
Like what?
And for a lot of them, like I said, there's more disappointment than success. And the Olympians that I know, everyone that I've met, is just incredibly dedicated to what they do. They're not making a whole lot of money. There are some Olympians that do make a lot of money, but the majority of them don't.
A super humble, super kind guy. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Alan Palander. Probably one of my favorite people to talk to, because every time I see him, he's just so happy. Yeah. He's just got like this big smile on his face. But speaking of smiles, I am excited to have this conversation with you, Nick, because I'm always intrigued by diving into the psyche of an Olympian and what it takes to be an Olympian and perform at the level that you have to perform at. Mm-hmm. One of my closest friends is also currently in the process of competing to get onto, I guess what's the right terminology? He's competing in tournaments to secure a spot in Paris mm-hmm. for Canadian beach volleyball.
Trying to gain a quota spot, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in Qatar right now, I think.
Yeah.
Playing in a tournament. But I wanted to get to know your story a little bit, because people see Nick the Olympian, mm-hmm. but who's the man behind the Olympian?
Just a small town kid with a dream, really. I've been doing the sport for a long time. Started when I was 12. I'm 24 now. Took a lot of years to kind of gain the experience, the time, the training to get to where I am today. I grew up in a small southern Ontario town, about 1,000 people, big hockey town. Didn't play a lot of sports growing up, just kind of some community sports, soccer, volleyball, basketball, nothing really that big until I found cycling. It was kind of like a happened by chance. Mm. It was nothing, never really part of the plan. I was at this leadership camp in Orillia, OELC. I got selected and I was in grade 7, I think it was. And we were driving back. We stopped in Vaughan at Montana's, I think it was. And the London 2012 Olympics were on. Women's team pursuit was going for bronze medal against, I think it was the U.S. at the time. And I said, what is this sport?
Like, and that's
and
when
that was
just,
the that was yeah. like the catalyst. And I just intrigued by the speed, racing around this wooden indoor track. What is this? Like, this is crazy. Need to see what more of this. Found it was a small track in London, Ontario. And I said, Mom, we're going. I was 12 years old. I'm like, I'm going. She's like, you're a bit crazy. But we ventured out there one Saturday and just kind of amazed by how steep the track was, how small it was, how tight it was. And there was someone there. I said, hey, do you want to try it? Got on the bike that day and just started riding around in circles.
Never looked
back.
Did
a few drills. Yeah, just got on the track and never really looked back, to be honest. Wow.
Do you ever remind your mom of...
Oh, she tells the story quite well. Oh, she tells the story quite well. Yeah, she was how horrified she was of the 45-degree banking and just that you're not riding this. There's no way you're getting on a fixed-gear bike with no brakes and riding
There's
around.
There's no brakes on these things?
No, no brakes. One
really?
Gear, no brakes. Yeah, direct drive.
Interesting.
No coasting. Yeah.
I guess. When would you ever really brake? You're just trying to go
Yeah, well, essentially, it's more dangerous to have brakes on if they're... than to not have brakes. You basically control the speed with your feet. Like you're kind of,
how so?
You kind of have to back pedal to mm-hmm. slow down. If you can't coast.
Yeah.
If you could coast, there'd be crashes all the time because it would just be like people stop pedaling and you bring yourself up because like you're basically controlled by a centrifugal force to being stuck on the boards. Mm. If you had brakes, you'd pull the brakes, you'd slide out, go down the track. There'd be a lot more crashes that way. So
wow.
It's a safety aspect as well, just the sport.
It makes the sport sound a lot more dangerous.
Yeah, I always say that this sport looks beautiful until things go wrong. Mm. Because when things go wrong, they go really wrong.
Yeah.
Everything looks great until it doesn't.
Have you ever had an accident?
I've had a few, yeah. Knocking on wood, haven't had one in a long time.
Yeah.
I had two bad crashes in 2015, basically back to back. There was one I was at home training on the road. on my track bike and fixed gear, like I said, I decided to stop pedaling. I guess I just didn't like have the cue in my mind that it was not my road bike.
Mm.
And I stopped pedaling at probably 50K an hour, and it just bucked me off my bike basically and tumbled, broke my collarbone, had a pretty minor concussion. But yeah, I have a plate and six screws still in here since 2015.
Oh, geez.
So there was that one. I recovered from that one, and then I crashed that fall, or that, yeah, I guess that winter, December, on the track in London. I was going too fast and something happened. I lost control and I went up and hit the railing. My bars locked onto the railing and spun my bike around, and I got tossed down the track. I basically out for a couple hours. I woke up in the hospital the next morning.
Wow.
And that's pretty, like, about a 6 week recovery from a concussion on that one. So haven't had a big one since, just a couple little slide outs.
Sure,
and
yeah,
some rashes and stuff like that, but nothing major since then. So been thankful that way.
Oh, absolutely. No, and I'm glad to hear that there hasn't been anything since. And like you said, knock on wood that there isn't anything going forward. It's interesting to me, whenever someone suffers from an injury of some kind, there's always that initial recalibration period afterwards, right? Like, what's going through your mind as you get back on the bike for the first time after that incident. Do you remember what that was like? Like, the first few thoughts that you had as you're about to get back on a bike, or was it just a seamless?
I think I was still pretty young at that point. I was eager to kind of just get back and get back into it. More recently, though, I injured my back in the build to Tokyo, actually.
Okay.
Basically, my SI joint got stuck.
The SI joint is?
Basically, like, low back.
Okay.
And no one could figure out what was going on with me. Basically, it got to a point where I couldn't walk anymore.
Oh, wow.
It was just so painful to get up and move and walk. And that was in the build up to the Tokyo Olympics. That was basically 4 or 5 months out from the Olympic Games. And I was starting, it's just kind of an injury that progressively got worse. It was a month of between chiros, physios, massage therapist, x-rays being done. No one could figure out what was happening with my back. I just slowly, progressively got worse. And that was a daunting experience because I was in the build to my first Olympic Games. I'd already been selected. We had already been going through that extra year of training, basically. It took me going home to my chiropractor in Chatham, actually, and he kind of figured out what was wrong and got unlocked and got into a rehab process of basically rebuilding. It took me about a month to rebuild. I was out of the gym, off the bike, basically doing like 30-minute spins. That was all I could do on the bike, and it was so painful. But that was a more daunting experience, for sure.
Do you ever think that it just wasn't going to work out and that was it?
There was real thoughts in my mind at that point that I wouldn't be going to the Olympics.
How did you persist through that?
That was tough. I think it's like, that one was tough. It's hard to kind of bring that one up because you build so long. My dream was always, a kid, was always to go to the Olympic Games, and we were so close. I mean, we had the extra year of training, kind of a tough battle to get through when we realized the games were postponed, got an extra year to train. I was in a really, really tight battle with my teammates. We were going back and forth all the time. We had the two spots, we were both going, but we were kind of battling it out in training every single day. I wanted to be faster, and then the injury happened, and yeah, that one was tough. It's one of those things you kind of have to just push through and take day by day. It's not something you really have control over until once it's happened. Mm-hmm. It's basically just how you can control coming back from it. And I just leaned on my team around me a lot. My partner, Sarah, really helped me get through that. She was amazing through the whole process, like just being there to support through the whole thing. My chiro, my team of physios, like it just, the coaches were all very supportive. It just took a big team to get me back on the bike after that one, kind of more figuratively speaking.
The mental game.
Mental game, for sure. I actually thought I might not go to the games. We were, the staff wouldn't let on that they were scared, but they were also nervous. And our head coach after the games, once I had finished competing in Tokyo, he told me, he asked me, he's like, you know, I was worried. I was worried you might not have been here this week because when I saw you, when I showed up, because he's from New Zealand, so he came in like later, he came in basically for the final build into Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, when I got here and you were doing 30-minute roller sessions, that's all you could do, I was a little bit nervous. But yeah, we just got it done. Just took it day by day and session by session, got back to being actually at my best in Tokyo. I never performed that level to what I did in Tokyo.
When you heard your coach say those words to you, what went through your mind? What'd you feel?
It was tough because it was like, after the Kirin in Tokyo, I was on the rollers cooling down. I kind of didn't have a great performance in the Kirin. I had a good performance in sprint, like a personal best in the qualifying and for sprint. There's two events I did, the sprint and the Kirin.
Sorry, can you clarify what the difference between
So basically, the sprint event is a two-person event. You basically do a 200-meter qualifier, so you go on the track by yourself and you do a qualifying lap, get seated based on your time, and you basically go one versus one to get down to like the later rounds to fight for the medals. Mm-hmm. Whereas Kirin, it's basically you get put into heats of six riders. Those six riders line up behind a Durni, which is basically a motorbike, electric motorbike on the track that brings you up to speed to 50 kilometers an hour and then pulls off the track with three laps to go. And basically all the six riders fight it out for first one to be across the line.
Wow.
So I had just finished Kirin when he came up to me at this point. I finished, I think, like 25th, 24th in the Kirin, which is out of 30 guys, it's not that great. I was a little bit nervous going into that event. And so I think I was a little disappointed in myself. So kind of have him like come up to me and say that was like a little bit reassuring, but I kind of went in one ear and out the other at that point because I was kind of disappointed in my performance.
How did you turn it around then? How did you like get out of your own way?
Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a weird like year with Tokyo because obviously that gap we should have after the games we didn't have. And I think it took me a long time to process what he had said because I took 10 days off after the games in Tokyo, and then I went straight onto a Nations Cup in Colombia to qualify for World Championships. It was that fall. So like it was pretty like back-to-back. It wasn't until that I finished Worlds in Roubaix that year in France that I kind of sat down and thought, shit, like what a crazy year that was. And that's when I started to really process the injury and like Tokyo and going to a Nations Cup, winning a first Nations Cup that we had to win in order to qualify to World Championships, and then getting to Worlds and just being like absolutely spent mentally, physically. I was done by the time we finished World Champs, and it was hard to get on the line in Roubaix. It was just like I was so exhausted mentally from that period of time leading into the games. And
well, between the injury and then getting there and then going through
I was definitely blocking it out. I mean, you're talking about the Olympic Games, which is like the pinnacle of our sport. Like I said, once I finished Worlds, I kind of started to process what had happened in the last year. I was still with the pandemic and everything's going on in the world, and the shit that I had to go through just to get on the line in Tokyo. And once I finished Worlds and processed everything that I went through, it hit me. It was a tough couple weeks after. Everyone always talks about like the post games letdown. Mine was almost the post-Worlds letdown because I basically didn't shut off from June 2020 to October 2021.
That's a long time.
It was a long time, yeah. And it took a lot out of me, for sure.
What did you learn from all of that? When you finally had that moment to sit down and think to yourself,
I just need to find balance.
Hmm.
Like it was, at that time too, we were still living with like teammates and team houses basically. So that was a bit mentally draining as well, and you're just in this environment space. And with pandemic, everyone was confined, like, you know, we were all kind of in that bubble per se. It was a very exhausting 18 months of everything that went on from early 2020 to the end of 2021.
Do you ever think about packing it in, just like, you know what, this took so much out of me?
I've never been that way because I always said that when I was a kid, I always said I want to do three Olympics.
Okay.
I want to do, you know, 2028 could be the exit. I don't know. I could go longer at this point. I don't know. I'm retiring at 28 in this sport would be pretty young.
What's the average?
A lot of guys last until like 30, 32.
Okay.
Some people exit younger. Depends on like their success in the sport and how long their body can take. But I have the unique situation that I've also been in the sport for a very long time. I've been doing it since I was 12, which is... And the time I get to LA, hopefully, that'll
LA is 2028.
Yeah, 2028.
Okay.
So Paris this year, 2028 will be LA. That'll be 10 years for me at the elite level, which the toll on your body
I can only imagine.
Is tough, just constantly training. Like, we train a lot.
What's your training regimen like?
Right now, we train five days a week, twice a day. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we lift in the morning. Monday afternoon and Friday afternoon, we do track in the afternoon. And then Tuesday, Thursday mornings, we do track in the afternoon. And then Wednesday, we have like an aerobic session, like a road ride or a aerobic track session and treatment on that day as well, like massage.
Yeah. So how do you fund all of this? Because the conversation I had with Daniel, the beach volleyball player, is he has to self-fund a lot of it.
Yeah.
Fundraising, sponsorship.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, know, I am carded at senior elite level because I am, like, based on, like, my performance, I am carded by the government.
And that allocates you a certain
amount,
allocates
me.
Yeah.
It's, like, $21,000 a year, which is, like, enough to
survive. If that. Yeah.
Everything else is, self-funded, like, I lean a lot on my social media, like partnerships, brand deals, sponsors.
You have to
build that. And my partner Sarah and I, we've been focusing on that a lot the last few years, and building social media and building our brands and working with brands and doing those brand deals, because it's so important to have that money to live. Like $21,000 a year is not a whole lot to be able to pay rent in the GTA, which is expensive. We live in Milton, and rent's expensive. We basically have to be here because we train at a national training facility. Like, we have to.
Where's the facility?
In Milton, Mattawee National Cycling Center. But we're.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
We basically need to be here.
Yeah.
To train on the track. We train on the track every day. Whereas the endurance riders as well, they'll come in for camps and competition preps. But they can kind of go home and do their own thing for the other weeks of the year that they're not training in Milton.
Right.
Whereas us, we're there year round. We live in Milton. Milton's home for me now.
Okay. So. This training regiment that you're in right now, you said today's a day off.
Today's a day off.
What do you do on a day off other than come in for a podcast?
Today.
Which now I feel bad about because I brought you in on your day off.
No, for sure. And it's like, rest is so important for us right now. Like, we're leading into the last couple competitions for Olympic qualifying.
Mm-hmm.
I go to Los Angeles end of March, and then I have the Home Nations Cup in Milton middle of April. So right now we kind of finished like a development block of training that we did after we came back from Australia earlier in February. It's kind of like a transition week before we get into like our pre-competitive phase leading into Pan Am Champs in LA and Milton Nations Cup. So kind of just had a bit of a modified training schedule this week. So this morning I slept in, got up at 8:30. Sarah had training today. So we got up, made coffee.
Is she a cyclist as well?
Sarah, my partner is also, Sarah's also a cyclist. She's basically the same role as me on the women's side.
Oh, very cool.
She's a sprinter as well. So we basically do the same thing all the time. We're together all the time. So she trained today. So we got up, made coffee this morning, and then she went to training. And I basically just laid on the couch for 2 hours, filmed some reels this morning, edited some content, and then just drove to Toronto for the podcast. So
having a partner that's in the same field as you, I imagine it allows you there's almost an unspoken understanding of the challenges that sometimes you don't always have to articulate them in so many words, because they're just that natural understanding of what you're going through.
Yeah. I think we're pretty good in that way. Like, she sees the good days and the bad days, and I have the same thing for seeing what she goes through every day. There's not many things we don't do together. Between travel, we go all the same races. Our training schedule is basically the same. We do all of our content together.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good.
You're lucky in that sense.
We've been able to build like a pretty like successful business, and we know what each other goes through on a daily basis. So it's pretty cool in that sense.
So you're gearing up for the Paris 2024 Olympics this summer.
Yeah.
What's one thing that you know that you learned from Tokyo that you're bringing with you in your quest for Paris?
I've been thinking about this a lot recently, because it's when I was building into Tokyo, I was not really at the forefront of the qualifying process. I was still very much a young developing athlete, and I didn't really come to the top of the Canadian team until like early 2020. At the last Nations Cup, the last World Cup we had in Milton, Home Nations Cup, and I was the fastest qualifier for our team. That's finally when I got to the top of the Canadian team. Whereas before, like, there's still that long qualifying process before that. So the guys that were ahead of me before were doing a lot of the points and accumulating the points and going to all the races that I wasn't going to while I was still at home training. Whereas this process, this last quad, I guess you could call it, modified quad, we work in like 4-year quads, this being modified quad with the 3 years of, I've been at the front the entire time. Like, I've been like leading the team, I guess you could say. A lot of the team now is younger than me, and trying to guide this team and do the points that we need to do and go to all the races and stuff like that's been a bit more challenging. It's been like a new challenge for me.
How do you not take your foot off the pedal, so to speak?
Really, yeah, for sure. It's, like I said, leading into Tokyo, I was just always building, always learning. Basically, everything I was doing, I was just getting faster and stronger the more training I did. But this time, I've, like, had to focus more on being intentional. And, like, when you're a developing athlete, the gains come much easier than they come now. Now everything's got to be, I'm thinking so much more about like recovery and my training and building my program with my coach just to make sure that I'm getting everything out of it. You know, everything's taken into account. Like even today coming into Toronto, like how is that affecting my recovery? Everything is taken into account. Whereas before I never really had that. I was always just, you know, just doing whatever. I was training, developing and getting faster. Whereas when you get later on into your career, the gains, so you could say, come a lot harder.
Yeah. There are fewer and far in between.
And so everything is taken into account.
Yeah.
And I think...
Do you like living in that world, in that environment where
it's a lonely world. It's a lonely world, that's for sure. I mean, like everything we do, like our social circle is not that big at all. Like we don't do a whole lot of extracurriculars, I guess you could say. A lot of our time we spend on the couch resting, legs up, feet up, just recovering, focusing on nutrition, focusing on recovery. It's a lonely life, that's for sure. But it's like both Sarah and I are so driven and like so motivated for like the goals that we want to do in this sport that are just we're okay with it, and we know why we're doing what we're doing.
So, in those moments when you notice the loneliness, how do you keep yourself motivated?
I think that's probably why like the social media content's come in so much. Like it's been like almost an outlet for both of us.
Okay.
Just kind of having that balance. Earlier on in my career, I didn't do a whole lot like social media based, and I was kind of just learning photography and videography like late 2018, 2019. Wasn't really taking the whole social media thing seriously. I was just watching a lot of Netflix, laying in bed between sessions, just kind of, I mean, I was 18, 19. I was happy to be training.
Sure. Yeah.
Didn't really, you know, wasn't really thinking about the future. Didn't really care. Just happy to be training on my bike, doing what I love. But now I'm really, really focused on building the other part of my career because, you know, sport doesn't last forever. And making sure that I'm developing that in a timely fashion, I guess you could say, is pretty important to me. So having that balance has been something that we've been able to put time into and just help to sort of just ease the pressure on the mind as we're training.
Obviously the goal going into Paris is to win. I've had a few conversations now with athletes about what happens when they reach for a goal and it doesn't necessarily translate, or how they essentially mentally prepare for that battle. Right, the possibility that you don't achieve the goal that you've been working so hard for, and the possibility that you come out on top and you're king of the world type of thing, and almost not letting yourself go too negative or too positive because you don't want to get too comfortable thinking it's going to work out, and you also don't want to make yourself feel like shit. Where do you fall in that spectrum?
I think you almost need to be okay with losing in the sport. I don't want to say okay with losing, but you have to learn to accept disappointment and how to deal with it, because at the end of the day, it's only 3 medals per event. You don't get medals for 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th all the way up to 10. There's 3 medals, and there's usually 30, 35 guys competing. I guess it's something you have to learn to manage disappointment. Because I've been disappointed in this sport more times than I've been satisfied. And I think it's just latching onto the good moments.
Yeah.
In last fall, we were in Chile for Pan Am Games, and we won the team sprint, which was a huge goal of ours for the team. And we did it. And it's just like, it was a huge moment for us. And you kind of just latch onto those good moments. I was talking earlier about like going to Colombia for the Nations Cup after the Olympics, and we had to win that event to go to Worlds in Roubaix that fall. And we did it. We won. We did a national record in terms of time, and we won the event. We won gold medal, my first time winning a World Cup. And you just hold on to those good moments and kind of just keep chasing it every time.
Yeah. Well, the point you make about there's a lot more disappointments than there are successes, I think is part of what a lot of people don't see when they look at Olympians, right? It's the same way when someone achieves some measure of success and you put it on your social media, they don't see the hard work and the no's and the rejections and the failures and the almosts that led up. So are you at a point where you're qualified, if that's the right word, for Paris?
Not yet.
Okay.
No.
What has to happen?
So basically, like I said, Pan Am Champs coming up in Los Angeles end of March. Basically, we're trying to qualify the team sprint, which is a timed event with three riders, basically all trying to drop each other. We race as a team, three riders. P1 leads us off. I'm P2, follows, and I drop, trying to drop P3 as fast as possible. The total time of the three laps is taken and then basically ranks you. So we're trying to qualify through that event where the top eight teams in the world get to go to Paris for the Olympics. If we do that, we qualify full quota spots for Canada, which would be three men. If we don't qualify the team sprint, we need to qualify individually, basically through sprint or through Kieran. And if we do that, we either have one or two spots, depending on that. And once we earn those quota spots, then we need to be selected to the team by Canada.
Jeez. So, like, you can... Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot you got to do just to qualify and then get your head in the right space.
So, we started this process last February in Indonesia for the First Nations Cup of a basically 14-month qualifying process.
Last February
we started. There's seven events total that we have to do around the world. So...
Okay. Sorry. I'm just thinking about like the length of time that you have to.
It's a lot. It's a big challenge.
And then the mental grind, I could only imagine.
It's a lot. Last season, like I said, we started in February in Jakarta. And then we had about a 6-week build into our Home Nations Cup in Milton. We're very fortunate because we get to have a Home Nations Cup each year, whereas some people don't. We did a 3-year deal with the UCI to have a Nations Cup 22. 23 and 24. So we have two of the seven events our Home Nations Cup for us, which is big for us that we're not having to travel. So last year we did Jakarta, then Milton, which was 6 weeks apart, and then 6 weeks after that we had Pan American Championships in Argentina, and then 7 weeks after that we had World Championships in Glasgow in Scotland. And usually there's two World Championships in the qualifying process, but because of the way they structured the schedule, there's only one. So Worlds last year is worth points and a half. So that was stressful. And then we went all the way to, we had basically a big break because Worlds for us are usually in October, but this year it was in August, 2023. It was in August because it was Super Worlds, but all cycling disciplines combined. So we had a big build into this Nations Cup season, which was, we started in February. We were in Adelaide in Australia. Now we have an 8-week build from that into Pan Am Championships, and then a 1-week difference between Pan Am Championships and Milton, and then after Milton will end the qualifying process for us.
Good luck, man.
That's intense. It's a long process. It's a very long process.
What don't people understand about Olympians? What do people...
There's a lot you don't see.
Like what?
And for a lot of them, like I said, there's more disappointment than success. And the Olympians that I know, everyone that I've met, is just incredibly dedicated to what they do. They're not making a whole lot of money. There are some Olympians that do make a lot of money, but the majority of them don't. A lot of people that I've even met, too, have even less funding than I do. I'm very fortunate to actually have the senior card. But everyone's just super passionate, super motivated, love what they do. And they want to compete at the Olympics. They just want to be at the top of their sport.
What's the difference when you say some people make money or have money through this? What's the difference between those people and the rest of the playing field? Is it just side businesses or sponsorship?
Yes and
or?
No. I think, like, you know, you got to point out, like, some of, like, the big name Olympians. Like, you know, you got to think about there's a lot of sports at the Olympics.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of them that get more airtime, more recognition, and than some other sports. I mean, you think the Olympics, you think the 100 meter, that's the pinnacle of the Olympics, whether you say it or not. The 100 meters pinnacle of the Olympics.
Yeah.
Everyone tunes in for that race. So there's Olympians that do make a lot of money. Some of them do have side businesses. Some of them are just have very successful personal brands. Mm. But there's a lot of niche sports out there.
Where does cycling rank in your mind?
I think track cycling at the Olympics gains a lot of recognition. I think it's a pretty spectator friendly sport when it comes to the Olympics. I think it does get quite a bit of airtime.
I think that's the thing, right? It's got to attract the viewers, the eyeballs.
Yeah, it's got to attract the viewers. Very spectator friendly because you can see the entire race happening. It's not like the road race where it's, you know, people go by and it's done. It's track cycling's all in front of you.
Mm.
The stance, see everything. You can see the infield, all the riders warming up, riders on the track. So in that case, it's really good. Yeah.
Okay. So what happens? I mean, I hope this is not too premature of a question, but if retirement for an Olympian in your sport is early 30s,
mm-hmm.
you got the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Are you ideating already on what you plan to do post career? Like, do you want to get into coaching? Do you want to, some people, like, go back to school? Is it, have you even thought that far?
I thought that far. And I think that's kind of why I put so much energy into learning videography, cinematography, photography now, because that's something that I want to do after. People always ask me about coaching, but I think I could be a good coach, but I also could not be a terrible coach, because I really tell people how it is. Like, I'd be almost too harsh.
Okay.
But yeah, it's hard because it's like you want to be so all in this sport, but you, whatever day it could be, it's going to end.
Yeah.
And having a backup plan. Like, I didn't go to school after high school. I turned 18, moved out of the house, moved to Milton, started training. And I basically self-taught myself photography and cinematography. And I don't know what avenue that could take, whether that be like through personal channels, personal platforms, and building on that, or actually going into the production space. I don't know where that may take me.
Yeah.
But I know that after the sport, that's where I want to end up, is somewhere in the media space.
Hmm. I want to go back to a moment. Your cycling career, or the cycling that you're doing for Paris, you're doing it individually and with a team, correct?
Yeah.
How do you navigate the egos, the ups and downs of competing for something so big
mm-hmm.
with other people, where your overall result is partially tied to, or not partially, but mm-hmm. some of it is what they do, right? Like mm-hmm. that's a lot of outside control.
I've been, like, the environment leading into Tokyo was difficult for me. I was, like I said, the younger kid coming up and still developing, still learning. And I feel like I've taken on more of, like, the senior team leader role, if you say, this quad. And we've got a really, really good group of guys. Like, we train well together. We all push each other. We know what we want. But that aspect does come into play, right? Like, if it comes down to a fact we only have one or two spots, everyone's going to want them. But it's just kind of a battle every day, making sure that you're doing what you can to be the best. And because the decision will be performance based, and who can perform the best at the Olympics in Paris.
Is there some solace in knowing that it's tied to performance and purely that? Like, I think when you say that, I think about, you know, it's almost like going for a promotion, mm-hmm. right? And then sometimes you wonder if so-and-so got the promotion over you because they have a better relationship with a person. Mm-hmm. But here, it's very much who has the best time.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's some silver lining in knowing that mm-hmm. you either had the best time or you didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, we're lucky in that case that we are a stopwatch-based sport. For the most part, I mean, there's racing, like one versus one, and tactics that come into play, but the stopwatch doesn't lie. And you got to show up at the race.
Hmm.
You got to show up on the day, and people have good days and bad days, but you gotta be hoping your bad days aren't on race days. Having the decision based on performance is like, yeah, it is, I don't want to say comforting, but the stopwatch doesn't lie. The results don't lie. It's not a, you know, who did better in like this day of training or who's lifting the most weight in the gym, or it comes down to who's performing best on the track. So I guess you could say like, yeah, I guess there's a bit of like understanding in that, and that the team knows it. We've been very clear about that, how the selection will go for Paris. But yeah, it's tough because we train together every single day. Everything we do together, like the boys, like we're all competing against each other, but we're all trying to be better every day as well. The three guys that compete in the team sprint, the three of us, like we've been very motivated on this goal together to qualify this team sprint for Paris. And it's a very young team.
Mm-hmm.
We had doubts in the beginning that we could do it, but we're right on the edge. It's possible. It'd be really cool if we did it. The team, Canada hasn't done that in a long time. I don't even know the last time Canada qualified team sprint to the Olympics.
Okay.
So it'd be really big if we did it.
And you're right on the edge. What does that mean?
So like I said, top eight teams qualify.
Right. Okay.
And we are in the 8-9 position. We don't have, like the European countries already have had like their continental championships, whereas we have our continentals coming up. There's a big points grab for that. So if we win that and get those points, it's going to bump us up in the ranking quite a bit. So we just kind of come down to the last few points based on the Nations Cup results. So it's like we're not one of the top two teams that's secured and tucked away for Paris. We're right on the edge of being in or out.
A lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. And there were a few races where we underperformed, one of them being Adelaide. We underperformed last year at Worlds too. We finished ninth by I think 0.03 of a second.
Wow.
Yeah. China beat us by 0.03. They got into the first round and we didn't. So
wow,
one of our big competitors.
It's gotta be heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is. One of our big competitors was Poland, and they qualified high at Worlds, but they made a mistake in the first round and they finished eighth. They had dropped their P3, and we think that if we were in that first round, we probably could have stayed together and done a better time than what they did, which would have put us ahead. Because our big fight right now is with Poland in terms of points and qualifying. So. Yeah, we had a bad day, and it's hard to have those bad days on race days.
Yeah. When you know you're in the midst of a bad day on a race day, what are you saying to yourself? How are you getting yourself out of that?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's all about, like, we've done the training. It's a lot of coming down to, you know, mental and, I'm a big numbers person. I try not to look at them on race day, but I somehow find myself creeping over to the numbers on race day. But yeah, it's gotta be positive self-talk, to be honest, is that's really all that it is. Like, there's nothing more you can do on race day other than just have confidence in yourself and back yourself, which is tough. Cause I mean, if you're not feeling great on race day, and I've had a few of those, it's tough to back yourself and be like, yeah, it'd be easier if I just didn't. But you just have to back yourself, really. Like, it's
how would tough. How would you get to Paris, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You will get to Paris. And you come in whatever place. How are you defining success for that?
I don't know what success looks like in Paris right now, to be honest. I think if I go to Paris and I finish top eight, I'd be incredibly happy. I think personally, I'm still developing as a track cyclist. I don't think I'm there yet. I don't think I'm at the top yet.
What separates you and the guys at the top?
Just time, speed, strength, power. I don't think I've quite nailed down my racing tactics quite yet. There's guys in the circuit that can make tactical errors, but they're just so strong and powerful they can make up for it. Whereas for me, I have to execute perfectly. I don't have that added bit of power that those guys have to have the bigger acceleration or have that top end speed that they have. So I have to execute races and be tactically good. And I think I'm still learning, still developing. I think I've seen big gains in the last year and a half. And hopefully that carries through to Paris. And I finished 14th in Tokyo. And I think that I'm in a much better position. Actually, I know I'm in a better position to top that result in Paris.
Were you disappointed by the 14th place finish?
Yes and no. I mean, I qualified 12th, finished 14th, but it was such a weird year, and such a weird year of building up to it. And as we talked earlier, just everything that I went through to get on the start line.
You're just happy to be there.
I was happy to be there. I was the fastest Canadian, which was a big one for me.
Mm-hmm.
But dealing with that injury, I don't want to say it wasn't an ideal prep because I was my fastest I've ever been. I did a huge PB in Tokyo. But I was really happy to be there. I raced well. I won the first round of sprint, which is a big deal for me to win a round at the Olympics. Even when race at the Olympics, it's huge. I mean, I was still 21 years old. I was the youngest competitor in the field. Just to be on the line that day, I was just so happy. Like, there's videos of me rolling up to the line with Franck, my coach. I'm just smiling, rolling up to the camera, because the camera is waiting for you on the line. And I was rolling up smiling.
Yeah.
Like, I'm at the Olympic Games. The dream that I had from as a kid, like, you made it. You did it. The rings are right there on the track. That dream you have is just like you're living it.
It's a surreal moment.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think that's when it was that moment was hitting me there. Yeah, I mean, I still smile thinking about it right now, but
yeah, you look it.
Yeah. It's hard to describe. Like, to reach that dream for the first time, like, I mean, I'm still dreaming of going to Paris and going to LA,
mm-hmm.
but for the first time to realize that, I mean, I was just happy to be there.
So what advice would you give to new Olympians? Anyone who shows up at Paris first time, what would you say to them?
Buckle up, because an Olympic environment is like nothing you've ever experienced.
What makes it so different?
You've got the Olympic Games, and it, like I said, it's hard to describe because it's like there's just like this buzz at the Olympics. I mean, we were fortunate enough that we were in a satellite village and we were in a satellite like venue, so we were allowed spectators because some venues weren't allowed spectators in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. But there was just like this, the people were amazing. They're cheering for everyone. Like, there was like a just this sense of excitement in the track, and there's a lot on the line. Everyone shows up with their new bikes, their new kits. Everyone's matching team attire. Like, you just, it's exciting. It's hard.
Intimidating?
Intimidating for sure. I mean, everyone's there to compete, and they want the three medals that are available. Everyone's fighting for the same thing.
Naturally, yeah.
It's just a special place.
Hmm.
When you see the rings in front of you and know that it's legit, you're there. And I think I was just kind of a starstruck kid being like so young, and going to this Olympics, there's definitely like that experience of digesting that first bit of hype around the Olympics. I've been to four major games now, two Pan American Games, one Commonwealth Games, and an Olympic Games. So I think I've kind of digested that environment of how a game system works. I mean,
do you get compensated for being at the games? Like, when you went to Tokyo, even though you didn't place in the top three, like, the I don't know if it's the government.
Like, things are covered. Like, it's covered. It doesn't cost me anything to go to the Olympics.
Okay.
All the team attire and everything's covered to go to the games.
Gear
is covered. Same thing. Yeah. Okay. But there is, in Canada, there's winnings for the medals. I think it's 20,000 for gold, 15 for silver, 10 for bronze.
Not a lot.
Not a lot, no. Whereas you look at some, like, I don't know exactly what country it is, but there's like a prize, like $1 million if you win a gold medal in this country, just because they don't have the big of Olympic team. They don't win medals. So I don't know what country that it is. I forget what it is.
$1 million would be nice.
Yeah. But yeah, it's not a lot, but
I think that's the biggest thing that people don't really comprehend about Olympians. We see them on television and we think, wow, pinnacle of athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best of the best of the best. And we're happy for you. We're rooting for you.
And most of them are broke.
And most of them are just broke.
Yeah.
And it's so sad.
Yeah.
Because it's like, how can you expect an Olympian to be their best
mm-hmm.
when they're also trying to figure out how to just put food on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's wild.
I know athletes in sports that like work part-time jobs, train in the morning, go to work, train at night.
Jeez. What needs to change?
A lot.
You had a magic wand.
Infuse more money in the system. But it's tough because it's like it. These niche sports don't get the airtime that some pro sports get. Like you go on TSN at night or whatever, there's five NHL games on.
Sure.
There's easy display of sponsorships on all these games. There's ticket sales. Whereas us, we have one Home Nations Cup a year. It goes on CBC Live online. Some people watch it. There's no sponsorship exposure.
Right.
So these big corporate brands that could put money behind these sports, and some do, but they just don't gain the exposure that, say, like an NHL team would give them.
Sure. They don't see the value in it.
Yeah, which is tough. I mean, what can we offer to them? I mean, it's easy to strap a logo on a Leafs jersey, and it goes on national TV.
Yeah.
Put some logos on the boards at the ice rink. It's tough to attract those big corporate sponsors that we need because they don't get the exposure that they'd want for their money.
Yeah.
A lot of like our funding is through government funding, like through On the Podium and Government of Canada. They pay, like there is quite a bit of funding, but it's still not enough. And everything's going up in price right now. And that funding, that funding amount isn't changing.
It's not matching the rising cost of living.
But it's tough.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, because a lot of things that could change, but I just need more money.
Yeah. Well, Nick, I sincerely hope that you're able to continue on this incredibly inspiring journey, first and foremost. And secondly, I am so excited. I hope that you are able to get to Paris. I know you're going to get to Paris.
Yeah,
positive.
That's the hope.
Get to Paris, crush it at Paris. And yeah, I hope you just keep doing the stuff that you're doing. Cause honestly, I have increasing respect for the athletes who are competing for their countries. The amount of work that's involved in it, the amount of time and dedication and sacrifices more than anything else, the things you have to say no to, there's so much. And I don't think people really comprehend that. So if you're listening or watching, support your athletes. Yes, the big mainstream pro athletes get all the buzz, but there's a ton of gems out there who are doing so much to wear that crest proudly. So thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I wish you the best of luck in your journey. And I would love to continue and have a part two post Paris if you're up for it.
We'll lock it in.
Yeah. Amazing. Nick, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, everybody.